Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. in the depraved, decadent hellhole of Washington, D.C. That is 9 p.m. in London, 10 p.m. in Paris, 11 p.m. in Cairo, midnight in Moscow, and sometime on Friday morning, pretty much for everyone else. And wherever you are, I'm glad to be with you on an unusual day for our Clubland Q&A, and in fact, a desperate and pitiful day at the United States Senate. If you've read or heard or watched me at almost any point since the Clinton impeachment trial, you'll know I loathe the United States Senate and all its works. I had the great honor when I was summoned to testify before a Senate committee a year or two back of pushing back against a buffoon of a senator. What's he called again? Senator Markey from Massachusetts, who was hectoring a fellow witness of mine, Judith Curry. And so I pushed back against him. He did that snooty, awful thing these twerp senators do of saying he hadn't asked me to speak. I didn't care, you know. I'd flown there at my own expense, just as I've done when I've testified at Parliament in Canada and other parliaments around the world. And so I started peppering him with questions. And I was told afterwards by a staffer that nobody had ever done that. They'd warned me beforehand I was supposed to respect the Senate. The Senate is unworthy of respect. And when this particular nomination, the nomination of a judge, that's all it is eventually disposed of, then it is worth thinking about the bigger issues underlying it. The Supreme Court has become far too important. It's become, in effect, a super legislature of nine robed regents. That's not what it was meant to be. It's not what it should be. And the idea, actually, of that kind of judge-made law is really repugnant. And I bemoan the way that other courts in Canada, Australia, elsewhere have begun taking that approach. It's disgraceful, terrible. One ninth of a judicial bench should not be as important as it is right now in Washington, D.C. And so we should make the Supreme Court less important. If that cannot be done, if it is going to stay that important, then it's far too important to let the clods of the United States Senate have anything to do with it. This is a pitiful spectacle we're watching in Washington right now. I congratulate Judge Kavanaugh, by the way, because he didn't respect the Senate either. He rightly mocked it. He pushed back against it. What Dianne Feinstein and her colleagues have done is absolutely terrible and disgraceful. And so if we can't get rid of the Supreme Court, if we can't get rid of the United States Senate, we should at least get rid of the Senate Judiciary Committee, because there is no point in having an unjudicial Judiciary Committee like the one that is sitting today. As I talk, he started speaking about an hour ago, and he pushed back very forcefully against the vile, filthy circus that these clowns are running that has managed to destroy him and his reputation in the space of 10 days, aided not just by the bad faith of Dianne Feinstein and her grubby, shoddy, disgraceful colleagues, but also by the dithering and stupidity of the Republican half of that committee. So I was glad to see Judge Kavanaugh push back. He said it was, in effect, a perversion of advice and consent. He said advice and consent had become search and destroy, as he put it. And he's quite right about that. He's quite right about it. It's an absolutely disgraceful spectacle. By the way, do you know where that advice and consent business comes from? All that that lingo. It's actually a holdover from England. If you look at any law passed anywhere within Her Majesty's dominions. It begins with that phrase. I knew a little bit. I took a little bit of an interest in this when I managed to get the disgraceful Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act repealed. But any act, any bill that is passed into law in Canada and becomes an act of law begins with the words, Her Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate and House of Commons of Canada, enacts as follows. And then you have the wording of the law. And I think in Westminster, it's a little, I think it's, if I remember correctly, it's Her Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Lords Temporal and Spiritual and Commons in Parliament Assembled, enacts as follows. But it's been a bit, anyway, that's really advice and consent. Same thing in any Parliament, Jamaica, Australia, New Zealand, whatever. And it is, and nobody thought how you can take that phrase and turn it into an inquisition on what some guy was doing in high school in the summer of 1982, whether he'd lost his virginity, and if he hadn't lost his virginity, where he'd got to on the continuum of getting up to losing your, whether he'd got, if he hadn't got to third base, had he got to second, had he got to first. This is pitiful, it's disgusting, and however it ends for Judge Kavanaugh, and you're not dealing with the strongest spined people in the world with the US Republican Party, it will have implications for where we go from here, not just on very real concepts like the rule of law, but in broader, more primal terms in the relations between the sexes. I don't know how many of you caught the special I did with Tucker Carlson last night. After Tucker's show, we did one of these one-hour special events to launch his new book, fine new book, Ship of Fools, and actually very good on the state of the American male. The American male is not in a good situation right now, and Tucker writes very poignantly about that. But at one point, I asked a question that had come in from a viewer about what was the worst attack and him worst moment in his professional life. And he talked about, this is going back 20 years, coming home late one night and being presented with an envelope in which some police department, I believe in Kentucky, a county prosecutor somewhere in Kentucky, had said that they were going to file rape charges against him by a woman he had never met in a part of the world he'd never been to. And he was, if you, it's never a good thing to get bad news and then try to go to bed and wake up all fresh and ready to go to deal with it in the morning. So he did, I've been in this situation too. You go to bed, you've had something absolutely earth-shaking, and you sort of lie there tossing and turning for 3 or 4 hours, and then you get up. And he said, after that false accusation, he got up at 3 in the morning, and he went and he had a cigarette. And it was so incredible what he was accused of that he began to think maybe he's got a brain tumor. Maybe he did this and he's just got some brain tumor or something that has blocked his memory of it. And then, of course, eventually he went back to bed and tried sleep. And when he woke up and it was 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, he realized it was nonsense. It was a false accusation. But he said something very interesting, Tucker, that he didn't tell anybody about it. He hired his lawyer, and he was acquitted, and the case resolved itself in his favor. But he said that if he'd actually gone to CNN and told them about that, they would have made him take a leave of absence from which he had never come back. He would never come back from that. And that's why he understands what Judge Kavanaugh is going through. The minute it's out there and it's out there instantly. He's got stupid there. I mean, if say you'd gone, like this third accuser, who the Democrats are pretending to take seriously, if you had seriously gone to 10 gang rape parties in Bethesda, Maryland, in the early 1980s, which, by the way, would make Bethesda the gang rape party capital of America, you might think that someone would have heard if there's all this gang rape going on. That's like 10 people. I don't know whether, I can't recall now whether they just pick one victim for these things, but that's 10 gang rape victims right there. If you seriously wanted to charge that Brett Kavanaugh is a gang rapist, would you go to that buffoon of a porn lawyer, the creepy porn lawyer, Michael Avenatti, too? This shames the United States. I mean, I've loathed the Senate since the impeachment trial. Loathed it. As I always say, New Zealand had a Senate, they abolished it. So as I always say that, I'll say the province of Quebec had an upper house too, and they abolished it. And I'd be very interested to see the same thing happen here. But this is disgusting. This is disgraceful. It's got nothing to do with advice and consent. It's got nothing to do with how you go about appointing a judge or confirming a judge. It's absolutely a grotesque spectacle that no human being should have to go through. And I was worried that Judge Kavanaugh, when he did his interview with Martha McCallum a couple of days ago, seemed just like a little bit bloodless. And I'm very glad instead that he got fired up and found some righteous indignation, because he's absolutely right to be angry about this. David Elstrom writes, and David really provides us with a thought for the day too. Mark, as I write this, we don't know the outcome of the Kavanaugh witch trial with its ever-growing and more lurid, fact-free, corroboration-free allegations. The damage that a Democrat win will do to rule of law is bad enough. Worse, a Democrat win will guarantee more such obscenities against any future appointees, because Democrats will conclude calumnies work. Calumnies, I should say. We'll conclude that calumnies work, along with Antifa, black shirt violence, intimidation of opponents in public places, and other, dare we say, fascist tactics in their ends justify the means playbook. But firstly, leftists are proud of their dirty tactics and congratulate themselves for taking down the devil of constitutionalism and the natural rights it seeks to protect. I guess they've never paid attention to my favourite scene from A Man for All Seasons, in which William Roper says, "So now you give the devil the benefit of law." And Sir Thomas More, the Lord Chancellor, says, "Yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil?" William Roper, "Yes, I'd cut down every law in England to do that." "Oh?" says Sir Thomas More. "And when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper? The laws all being flat. This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast. Man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down, and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake." And that is what is being done right now. A great road is being cut through the law to get after the devil Kavanaugh. And when the Democrats have succeeded in chopping down core legal principles like the presumption of innocence, the right to confront your accusers in open court, when all those laws are cut down, we will all have difficulty standing upright in the winds that will blow around then. Thank you for that, David. This is a disgraceful moment for the Senate. It's quite absurd. We have a system that, you saw it today in the difference between the dogged assistant, I believe she's a deputy county prosecutor from Arizona, speaking for the Republicans every 5 minutes, and then the Democrat senators speaking every 5 minutes. And she would have been a good, effective, I'm sure she is, a good, effective prosecutor if you're in a county courthouse in Arizona where you're appealing to a judge or to a jury. And you're going doggedly through. And everyone, because people watch TV legal dramas, they think it's all got to be, aha, you, sir, testified that you were at the 7-Eleven on Elm Street at 8:50 p.m. On March the 27th, whereas, in fact, you were 200 miles away somewhere. Actually, we had a moment like that. If you, I might as well mention this. If you go and look at the CRTV versus Stein verdict that's up at our website, and also it's up at Stein Online, but it's also, if you want to get it straight from the New York courts, it's on the New York court website. There's a moment in that where a guy perjured himself, a witness for CRTV perjured himself by claiming to have been, I think he was with a family member in Albany when he was in fact up for dirty business down in New York City. He was a key witness for CRTV, and the judge found that he perjured himself because he wasn't where he testified under oath. Everyone thinks that's very rare to have a gotcha moment like that. Normally what they do is what this deputy county prosecutor did in the Senate today. You ask these questions, and it doesn't seem very dramatic, but at the end of the hours, you have a three or four telling lines that, taken together, cast doubt on a particular core part of the witness's testimony. And you can use them then in your closing argument to the judge or your closing argument to the jury. That doesn't work that way in what's going on here, because every 5 minutes she's asking these perfectly normal court questions and giving what's happening the veneer of a judicial exercise. And then in between, all the Democrats are saying, oh, I so admire your courage in coming here today to speak your truth, as they all said. Courage, 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 courage. Which basically means that Cory Booker admires his own courage in coming there to strut and preen for 5 minutes before handing back to the deputy county attorney. We all do that. I admire my own courage in coming to speak my truth today. But thank you for reminding us of what is important. PK33 writes, now that two men, whatever kind of name that is, now that two men have apparently anonymously for now come forward claiming they were the boys at the high school party, the ones involved in the assault encounter with Christine Blasey Ford, will they be given the presumption of guilt and thereby relieving it from Kavanaugh, or will the Dems give these two men the presumption of innocence and continue to presume Kavanaugh guilty for convenience sake? Cue the Jeopardy music and you only get one answer. Yeah, that goes back to what David Elstrom was saying in that Man for All Seasons case. You know, the old, Matthew Hopkins, I think that was his name, who was the sort of self-appointed witch finder general in England. And he used to go around finding witches. And his means of testing whether you were a witch was to see, one of them was to put you on a so-called ducking stool, and that's where you'd be tied to a chair and then ducked into the river or a pond. And if you came to the surface, that was proof that you were a witch, and so you'd be burned at the stake. But if you drowned, that was proof that you were innocent and you weren't a witch. But you've drowned, so it's not much consolation. And that's basically the situation that Judge Kavanaugh is in. That even if he is not a rapist, the Democrats intend to drown him anyway. Jay Barney, that's not really a question, Jay. What's your question? 1 p.m. in Apache Junction, Arizona. The hour is more civilized than the locals. I don't think I'll comment I don't think I'll comment on that one. Walt Trimmer says, do you think that the Kavanaugh hearing is a watershed in American politics? Or are we going to see this done again and again without a strong response from Republicans and men in general? You don't need to, I mean, men are done for in the Western world, Walt. And you know, when you look at something like the transgender movement, in a sense it makes perfect sense, because who the hell wants to be a man these days? Again, this is something Tucker and I talked about last night. If you look at the really the significant gap now open, everyone thinks, oh, we need to do more for gender equality. Gender equality. I'm all for gender equality. We need to reverse the gender gap. The gap between the sexes right now is that men are screwed. All the male type jobs have gone, and the jobs that survive are generally cubicle jobs that are done by women for not particularly fancy elevated jobs. And then all the fancy jobs, like if you go to the law schools, they're overwhelmingly dominated by women. Universities are dominated by women. The gap in bachelor's degrees favors women so much now, they should change the term to spinster's degrees. Old sexist joke. The gap in master's degrees is even wider, so they should change that to mistress's degrees. And PhDs. I can't do a joke with that. I don't know what they call a female doctor. Doctorette? Anyway, all these things, lawyers, doctors, all of it, women now have opened up a significant gap at universities. Men, in fact, are falling behind, and yet we still talk about it in these incredibly old-fashioned terms. So I don't think it's worth... I think what's interesting to me about this, Walt, you say a strong response from men in general. Men can't even speak to this, which is why... And you saw that today when basically 11 Republican senators, terrified of it looking like 11 old white Republican men, as they always say, quizzing poor Dr. Ford... terrified of how that would look. So hiring a female lawyer from Arizona to come in and talk for them. And in that sense, she did perfectly fine. She if you think of how it would have looked with all those Republican white men and the press that it would have got, and the mess they would have been in if there had been just one verbal misstep, including the nearest they got to that, I think, was right at the end when Chuck Grassley said, "Now it's time for me to say something nice about you, Dr. Ford," which looked as if he was accidentally reading out his stage directions. It's not going to be men who change this. It's going to be women. With Tucker last night, I was talking, he asked me about this thing, CNN's Jim Acosta, Trump's press conference, and the president calls on Jim Acosta from CNN, and he stands up and he says in this rather sort of priggish way, "I'd like to ask that the next question you take is from a woman. Because I think it would be nice if you let a woman come forward." He's like preening, it's total sexist condescension. No self-respecting woman reporter needs a twerp like Acosta to facilitate her answering a question of President Trump. Totally stupid, condescending, witless. But also behind it is the assumption that all women... 51% of the population, all of them think the same. And they don't. They don't. Because the majority of these women are wives who love their husbands, mothers who love their sons, daughters who love their fathers. And this idea that simply by virtue of being a man, you're in the wrong, and by virtue of being a woman, you're in the right. That is not the world that most of these women live in. And so what will matter here, Walt, is not whether Republicans or men or white men or old white men push back, but that the majority of American women are also disgusted by the spectacle. Leslie B. writes, how do you suggest individuals push back against the wolf pack mentality of the left? How can individuals preserve their lives and safety when all of the media and social media networks enable the mob? Is there also any recourse to people whose lives will forever have a digital footprint of grotesquely false accusations? Sue Google? Well, you can't actually under American defamation law. Mark Judge, the other man, as it were, in these accusations. I don't know him, but when he started writing, which I would guess is 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, he used to write under the byline Mark Gavreau Judge, and he used to write about pop culture, hither and yon. And I think he wrote a couple of pieces for the Washington Post or something, and every so often he'd quote me something I'd said about a play or a movie or a song or whatever. In those days, I don't know whether he is now, but in those days, he was quite a big fan of mine. That's the only kind of connection I have with this guy, Mark Judge. And he's not a, you know, world-famous writer. He's not J.K. Rowling. He's someone who, I would imagine, struggles, like 99.99% of writers, to make much of a living at it. And so at one point, maybe in 20, 30, 40 years' time, he'll want to apply for a job somewhere. And his putative employer will Google him, and the first 4,000 pages that come up will be about how he organized gang rape parties throughout Maryland for the entirety of the 1980s. There's that kind of capriciousness, the whimsy of that, is actually the definition of a totalitarian society, because everyone starts to keep their head down. Maybe you won't catch their eye if you just keep your head down. Maybe it'll be that guy Mark Judge who lives four doors down the street from you, or maybe it'll be someone else who lives 10 minutes away. Someone will catch their eye, and it'll be pretty arbitrary, and they'll destroy him. And the net result is that you all keep your head down. And you have to push back against that, Leslie, because the alternative is tyranny. And I would make another point, too. I said this on Rush a week ago, that this is the politics of the campus. I mentioned that Tom Wolfe, the great Tom Wolfe, Bonfire of the Vanities. After Bonfire of the Vanities, he wrote a novel called I Am Charlotte Simmons about a girl at an American college. And so he went to a lot of colleges, and he sat in the back of the classroom. And Tom Wolfe told me that he thought the whole political correctness thing was just something they paid lip service to, pretended to go along with, and then forgot it the minute they graduated university. And I think that is actually not what happens, and it would be unlikely for it to be what happens. We now have decades of people who are marinated in safe spaces and triggering and all the rest of it. And so the abuses of concepts like free speech, due process, the presumption of innocence that are standard on the average American college campus have now escaped the campus. And those people are, in many cases, staffing and in some cases running major media institutions, major political institutions, major academic institutions, and eventually they'll be sitting on the Supreme Court. They've been raised that way. And the teachers who teach them have been raised that way. And the idea that you can keep it all crammed up in crazy land on campus, you can't do it. It's escaped the campus and it's stalking the land. And I will say, too, this is where identity politics leads. It's the Stalin, as I can never remember whether it's Lenin or Stalin, who distilled identity politics, essentially, to two words. Who? Question mark. Whom? question mark. And every time I've used that who, whom line, I've been asked about it. That formulation, I believe it was first used by Lenin. And it, what it basically means is the minute you know who the who is and the minute you know who the whom is, you know who the good guy and the bad guy is. So if it's woman versus man, woman the good guy, man the bad guy. If it's gay versus straight, gay the good guy, straight the bad guy. If it's Muslim versus Christian, Muslim the good guy, Christian the bad guy. If it's gay versus Muslim, don't worry about that. It all gets a bit more complicated, and we're not actually sort of clear on the who whom business just right now, and we're all pretending it's not going to come to that. But for most of them, it's quite plain, like this. The minute we believe women, we believe women. Ted Cruz, chased out of a restaurant with his wife. An appalling scene. A fancy restaurant, so one assumes, they're catering to, you'd think it would be a place you could go to get away from the mob. But again, as Tucker and I discussed, this is a kind of inverted revolution. It's rather as if the French aristocracy have picked up pitchforks and have risen up against the peasants. And so you have this mob, howling, baying mob, yelling at Mr. and Mrs. Cruz and yelling, "We believe survivors, we believe survivors." So automatically, simply by making the accusation against Kavanaugh, this lady, Ms. Ford, is a survivor. And Harry Selden writes, "Given your knowledge of history, what's the most fitting historical comparison to judge Kavanaugh's hearings today?" You can pick almost any historical period. I mentioned just now Matthew Hopkins and the old the test to determine whether somebody was a witch by putting them on a ducking stool. So if you floated, you were a witch and had to be executed. But if you drowned, you were innocent. And so that's basically the choice facing Kavanaugh at the moment. But I do think the more recent comparisons, I was very, one of the interesting things is features. I spent a lot of time around and after the fall of the Iron Curtain in the nations of the Warsaw Pact in Central and Eastern Europe. In East Germany, in Bulgaria and Romania, Hungary. And what was interesting to me was that there was a lot of finger pointing. Finger pointing became a way of life because allegations, when you've got the secret police that who don't have to worry about anything, then allegations are enough. So you can just randomly finger someone you don't like and destroy him. And that's what's happening. That's what's happening here. But it's only happening one way. And again, it's being done with the connivance of a very supportive media that won't, for example, mention the accusations against the number two guy in the Democrat Party, number two guy at the DNC, Keith Ellison from Minnesota, who is credibly accused by his most recent girlfriends of being a physical abuser. That goes nowhere, but something from 40 years ago, it can be used to destroy a man. Michael Cavino writes, "Is the hearing today not the best example for taking TV cameras out of the confirmation hearings? It would stop the grandstanding by politicians of all stripes. Put them on radio so we can hear them. Similar to how the Supreme Court does when it releases audio of oral arguments after hearings for big cases. Love to hear your thoughts, Mark. Thanks." Yeah, I think so. I think, I'll go back to what I said a little earlier about that, Michael, because I said it had the veneer. It has the veneer of a judicial proceeding. You're sworn in. You're under oath. There are lawyers present. Some of those lawyers make objections to questions. The chairman rules on those objections. That's very much as it would be if you were in district court somewhere. But of course, it's not. All 10 Democrats are basically trying to come up with the soundbite that will be big on the network news. They're not interested in persuading the judge. They're not interested in persuading a jury. They're interested in showboating. What was interesting is that I believe within the first 3 hours of her testimony this morning, 3 big shot Democrats had sent out fundraising appeals based on, quote, the survivor, unquote, Christine Ford. Again, that tells you the purpose of that thing. Now, I think these confirmation hearings are stupid. They're not actually. There's no requirement for them. Mitch McConnell, if he wanted to do the nation a great service, could simply say, after what the Democrats have done, after Cory Booker and his I Am Spartacus moment, after Kamala Harris disseminating lies, after Dianne Feinstein stiffing the guy she's sat next to for decades, poor old Grassley, by sitting on this allegation by Christine Ford for the entirety of the hearings and then going nuclear just as they're about to take the vote. I think Mitch McConnell, there's no requirement to have this guy. As I said, it's nothing to do with advice and consent, which is a concept arising from the society you guys left behind. It meets nobody's definition of advice and consent. And I think McConnell would be right to say this fiasco, this circus degrades us all. It degrades us all. It's an embarrassment to a serious grown-up nation, an old established nation, 240 years old, whatever it is now. It's embarrassing and degrading. And so until further notice, we're not having these committee hearings for judges. We'll just have a straight up and down vote on the floor of the Senate. He'd be within his rights to do that. Fizz Rad wrote, in some ways, the Kavanaugh Me Too businesses remind me of the 80s and 90s daycare worker sex abuse hysteria, though our current hysterias seem more politically motivated. There was some politics in the other hysteria, as documented in Dorothy Rabinowitz's book, No Crueler Tyrannies. What do you think? Are these things cyclical, or are we Americans simply crazy? Dorothy is one of the great figures in American journalism for what she did. Largely in Massachusetts, people had their lives destroyed over these so-called recovered memories, false memories. People were damned as Satanists and pedophiles and all the rest of it. And Dorothy investigated it doggedly. She befriended many of these unjustly convicted people, and she pushed back against everyone in the system. Corrupt prosecutors, corrupt judges, and corrupt political establishment. All that goes without saying in a dump like Massachusetts. And eventually she prevailed, and it was great work. It was a moment of madness where these things come. They're kind of moral panics. And the precise danger in them is when you start saying things, as we hear now, oh, you have to believe survivors. No, no, no. It's never that. That's a land without law. That's a land without law. That would destroy every. I mentioned courtroom dramas at the top of the show. I like courtroom drama. I like Witness for the Prosecution, Agatha Christie, all that kind of thing. I love it. But it would destroy the basis of most of them, because every exciting, thrilling courtroom drama understands that it's not the Leninist whom thing. Once you know that, oh, this lady seems nice and credible, so she's a woman, and she seems nice, so she couldn't possibly be lying. So yes, she's the she wins in the trial. The whole point about the law is that it doesn't. That's not meant to matter. If you run a red light, it doesn't matter whether you're a Ku Klux Klansman or you're Nelson Mandela. The point is, Nelson Mandela isn't allowed to run the red light either. Everyone says, "Oh, look at that! You run the red light. You run the stoplight, and you run over some nice poor little Dickensian urchin, 7 years old. You bad, bad Klansman." No, he's not bad because of who he is. He's bad because of what he's done. And if you run over the seven-year-old Dickensian urchin, that crime is not worse because you're a Klansman or you're, and it's not ameliorated because you're Nelson Mandela. The law is the law. We are all equal before the law. And this assault on equality before the law is the moral panic of those 1980s daycare stories. Gone national and now embedded. That moral panic, which was for a few daycare facilities, is now actually at the world's most venerable daycare facility, the United States Senate, where all those ludicrous figures, 100 of the most risible and pathetic figures in America, each has a vast retinue of 60 or 70 people to babysit each and every one of them all day long. So, as I said, the Senate is the world's biggest daycare facility, and we shouldn't be surprised that we've ended up there. John Wilson writes, "No one likes to mention the word, but it seems the left is itching for an actual as opposed to figurative civil war. What thinkest thou?" Yeah, this is something else Tucker and I talked about, that when you see what's going on with the that scene with Ted Cruz and his wife in that restaurant, you are beginning to get the sense that there are two groups of people now, and they can no longer really inhabit the same real estate. And I know there's a third group of people, and they're the people who just want to get on with their lives, get up in the morning, put on their clothes, go to work, come home, have dinner, watch a couple of hours of TV, and go to bed. And they're not part of these two groups who can't live together. But in any society, it's not just about the majority. It's about who has the vigor, who has the energy. And you sense the bloodlust when you see the mob. They've cited someone they know from TV as a Republican or a right winger or a conservative, and he's in the restaurant, and they pour in. They go to the restaurant. He can't even have a meal. He can't even have a meal. And there's more and more of that. I'll say a word about this at Stein Online maybe next week. But I was at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis about this time last year, speaking to Michelle Bachmann was there, and John Hinderaker from Powerline was there. And at the same event this year, they're going to have Alan Dershowitz. And John Hinderaker wrote at Powerline that unfortunately they can't go. I love being at the Guthrie. I was on the set of, I think it was Romeo and Juliet, and it was a beautiful theatre in the round. And I said to John as we left, "I love this theatre. I'm happy to come back here anytime you want." Well, John wanted to go back there, so he tried to book it for his big speech by Alan Dershowitz. And they said no. They didn't want his business anymore. They didn't want, I think, the 40 grand he was going to pay to rent the space, because some of these little people had been working the staff of the theatre. They'd been a little triggered by my speech, and they felt it. They didn't want me in their safe space. Okay, fine. So now we've got, it's a 50-50 nation, and there's something very odd about when businesses that are supposed to be open to all, like this particular theatre or a restaurant, find they've got to choose people based on their political ideology. You know, you've got to be very careful taking a booking from Ted Cruz. Now, I had this in when I was in Copenhagen with Douglas Murray. I mentioned this before, the 10th anniversary of the Muhammad cartoons. We had a restaurant cancel our dinner reservation because the security detail from the Danish intelligence service put them off. That's reasonable because they don't want some crazy jihadists finding out where we're having dinner and shooting up the joint and people dying. So in a sense, that's the great conflict of civilizations. They're the people who, 9/11 and all that. You can understand why you wouldn't want ISIS finding out that me and Douglas Murray and a group of other desirable targets are having dinner in this particular restaurant. But what we've got here is that, what we've got here is actually worse. It's Democrats deciding that Republicans can't eat in a particular restaurant. And at that point, you really don't have a lot of, you don't have far to go except civil war, because you can't even go to a, and it doesn't have to be like the restaurant Ted Cruz was in, it can be the one like Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You can't actually go to even like a quite ordinary diner. That's got to be politicized now. And in the end, there's nothing left. There's nothing left. Robert Stewart writes, Mark, every day I receive 2 phone messages and 3 or 4 emails from one or another of the National Republican campaign committees asking for donations. Do you think they understand that my support for them is conditional on their performance? All the talk about Kavanaugh focuses on speculations about the effect of the hearings on national polls. Do you find the absence of any discussions dealing with the responsibilities of the Republican majority to do its duty as discouraging as I do? Why would I donate to a group that predictably follows national polls to the exclusion of any thought about what is right and proper? That's well put, Robert. I think, when you look at polls are useful to a certain extent, because sometimes they can give you more information on the result. I don't think it's difficult to say, for example, what Trump voters were supporting when they voted for him in 2016. What you might call the hardcore Trump voters were voting for a wall that Mexico would pay for, because they had made the connection between mass illegal immigration, and indeed actually mass immigration generally, and the economic slough in which their own lives were mired. They'd made the connection between their access to the American dream and immigration. So they were voting for a wall. It always got, and it gets to this day, although obviously people are beginning to get a bit skeptical, but if you were at a Trump rally, I believe I was actually at the first rally at which Trump said, what are we going to build? A wall. And who's going to pay for it? And we all yelled back, Mexico. And he thought that was great. And he said he might do it like that from then on, which he did. And that was for hardcore Trump supporters. That was the thing. There were other people who wanted the repeal of Obamacare, which the Republican Party had been committed to by that point for almost a decade. And then there were other people, the kind of clothespin voters, who didn't like Trump, didn't like his style, didn't like this, didn't like that, but they were willing to stick the clothespin on their nose and go to the polls and vote for him over Hillary, because they would get conservative judges confirmed to the Supreme Court and to lower courts. And here we are, 2 years on, 2 years into Republican control of the White House, Republican control of the Senate, Republican control of the House, and there's no wall, and they haven't repealed Obamacare. And so that's the last thing That's the last thing left. The reason why all those clothespin voters said, oh, you know, we're going to get the Supreme Court thing. If they can't do this, and they bungled it, you know, Grassley dragging this thing out, delaying it 10 days, as Kavanaugh said less than 2 hours ago, the 10 days destroyed that man's life, destroyed his family. That's how he put it. And he's right. You imagine being those girls having to go to school and the sex beast of Bethesda is your father. That's what Chuck Grassley let happen. You know, in the end, if you were just admiring the parties on how they play this game, the Republicans aren't even playing. They can't play it. They're stumble bums staggering around while all these wizards, we do applaud your courage for coming here and speaking your truth. This is important to them, the Democrats. It's important to them for this reason. Right now, it's a 5-4 swing court. Anthony Kennedy, it's a nation of 320 million. You threw off monarchy because you didn't want one person making every important decision. And you replaced it with a system in which there's lots of people low down who vote this way and vote that way and do this and do that. And then eventually it all comes down to 9 judges sitting in a room. And 4 of the judges are on the left and 4 of the judges are on the right. And so Anthony Kennedy is a supersized George III who gets to do things like George III would never have dreamed of, like redefining marriage to let a man marry a man and a woman marry a woman. He was a far more modest chap in that respect. But that's who Anthony Kennedy is. And that's important to the left. The left could live with the 5-4 swing thing because on everything important, Anthony Kennedy tended to swing their way. Replacing Anthony Kennedy with this guy risks, for the moment, a 5-4 originalist, radical majority vote on. There'll be less swing voting, and things will become a little more less favourable to the radical left in that respect. And they're rightly concerned about that because they control everything else. It doesn't really matter who controls Congress. I mean, look at these useless guys. What difference does it make if McConnell's supposedly quote unquote running the Senate and Ryan's quote unquote running the House? These guys control the media, as we know. They increasingly control corporations, all of whom. Essentially, the most powerful and influential corporations regard it as necessary to strike Democrat liberal attitudes in their public discourse. They control the sources of information, which we dignify as social media. Google, the most powerful company on earth. As you know, when you ever get this, some of them are eavesdropped on and taped. They understand precisely when it comes to elections, and they have to put their thumb on the scale, which side of the scale they have to put it on. So they control all that: Google, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all the rest. They control the pop culture, the pop songs, the movies. They control the education system. Not just wacky courses at university, but they actually control it all the way down to kindergarten. The default setting of society on most issues in the average. You go to a public kindergarten in a so-called red state and look at what they're teaching the kids about, say, climate change. The default setting is greatly favors the left. And the one thing that would confirm them and cement them in their power is not control of the House of Representatives or the United States Senate or even the White House, but just denying that Anthony Kennedy seat to someone like Brett Kavanaugh, just putting someone on there who's a little bit closer to the Stephen, you know, it doesn't have to be a radical leftist, just a Stephen Breyer type you don't hear about terribly much. That would cement them. They understand. They're serious about power. They're serious about power. And you shouldn't underestimate them when you look at what they do and why they do it. Rich writes, "Hi, Mark. Love the club. I'm glad to hear you love the club. We love the club too, and we love having you guys in the club, and I'm looking forward. It's Thursday, and I believe in pretty much exactly 48 hours, we'll be leaving the quay in Montreal and going on the St. Lawrence over to Quebec City and thence out to sea and down the beautiful eastern seaboard with our club members. The cruise is sold out. I thank you for that. And we look forward to seeing you on the Michelle Bachmann I mentioned. We're going to be live with Michelle, I think that's Sunday. And so I'm looking forward to that. So thank you. I'm glad you love the club, Rich, and I hope to see you on next year's cruise if you're not on this one. Rich says, "I felt a number of different emotions due to politics, but the Kavanaugh smears left me genuinely furious. Democrats may not have liked Mitch McConnell refusing a vote on Garland, but congressional Republicans and the media did not team up to accuse Garland of being a drunken rapist two generations ago. By extension, yesterday was the first time I kept thinking to myself, thank you, President Trump. Don't get me wrong, I voted for the guy. He's done some things I like and others I don't. But for him to take questions directly from the media and call this circus a con game could not have been any more accurate. The Democrats are not delaying to find victims. They're delaying to find volunteers. Anyone who cannot see through this is either hyper-partisan or a useful idiot." I was glad to see, Rich, the righteous indignation of Brett Kavanaugh today. I use that phrase deliberately because I think I've been, you know, I think about this a lot. I've been, as you know, I've been tied up in court longer than I expected to be. And you can be clever and you can be modest and you can be reasonable and you can be soft-spoken. But if what is happening to you, and obviously what's happening to Brett Kavanaugh is far worse than what those grubby twerps at Carrie Katz and his associates did to me. But you always have to have a moment where you show that you are genuinely angry at what's being done. And I can't think of anything. I didn't love it. I mean, I felt embarrassed for the poor man listening to him earlier because he's clearly upset. He's upset because Chuck Grassley in 10 days let the Democrats dismantle his previous half century. And as I said, turn the 40-year-old virgin into the rape beast of Bethesda. Absolutely appalling. Absolutely vile. And Dianne Feinstein and whatever Chinese spy on her payroll put her up to this, Dianne Feinstein knew this. And as I said on Rush, what they are doing is evil, and it shows you. It's basically the old communist apology. You can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. And they can't build you the identity politics utopia without breaking a few little nobody, nothing people along the way, like Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge and all the rest of it. It is terrible. I don't know where we go from here, but I do know that that in the end, this if they don't get this guy through, then the rationale for sticking with the Republican Party, the last rationale is they'll put judges on courts. You've got to get serious about this stuff. You can't be a judiciary committee that doesn't believe in the presumption of innocence. You can't. You simply can't. I quoted on TV last night, I quoted Viscount Sankey, Lord Chancellor, and you get a little garbled and hasty. And so, but I meant what I said when I said it was like Sankey, immediately after the Second World War, put his name to this kind of Bill of Human Rights that eventually became the UN Declaration of Human Rights. That's what the presumption of innocence is. It's so vital and basic. It's a universal human right. And as Sankey said, Lord Sankey said, it's the golden thread of English law. You can't shred that. You can't get your scissors and snip that up, that golden thread, into quarter-inch pieces and call yourself a judiciary committee. You've just trashed the fundamental principle of justice and of law. And you call yourself a judiciary committee? To hell with you guys. It's vital to get this done. Absolutely vital to get this done. Deborah writes, this will close it out because this one gave me a bit of a chuckle. Deborah writes, Mark, our oldest granddaughter is a freshman in college with a plan to major in journalism. Can you recommend a few books for her conservative nana to send her way that might stand a chance of counteracting the academic progressive indoctrination process I assume she will be experiencing? Thank you for your help, Deborah. Deborah, don't let... Mamas don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. I'm indifferent on that. But don't let your babies grow up to be journalists. There's no point spending $250,000 to major in journalism, which right now is, I think, paying $30,000 a year, if that, if you can find someone to hire. All over, I don't know what part of the country you're living in, but in my part of the world, the newspapers get thinner and thinner and they lay off more and more. I would not advise. I had this with a neighbor of mine, actually. They built their they dragged their mill wheels up the Connecticut River in the 1760s, chopped their way into the interior and built, I think it was, the third house in town. And that family had lived on that homestead for over 250 years. And they were proposing to mortgage it so that their oldest daughter could go to Columbia Journalism School because she wanted to work at the Atlantic Monthly, where she dreamed of editing my monthly obituary that I used to write for them back in those days. And I never went to Columbia Journalism School. I certainly wouldn't pay any money to major in journalism. And you certainly didn't need it. The idea that you to write my column in the Atlantic, you don't need a degree. But to copy edit it, you have to go to Columbia Journalism School and mortgage the homestead that's been in your family for a quarter millennium. I thought, well, that was tragic. So don't do that. Don't tell your granddaughter to do something else. If she wants to write, she should read great books and write. And going there to study, you know, journalistic ethics from the people who brought us this last 2 weeks in American public life, I wouldn't wish that on any freeborn citizen, Deborah, and neither should you. She should tell her to major in something real, because majoring in journalism. Journalism right now is not real, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Thank you for that. Thank you for that that question. We had lots of questions, and the hearing is ongoing. We will be talking about it, I take it, as this shakes out, on the Mark Stein Cruise. I'm not sure whether it's technically possible for us to do a Clubland Q&A live from international waters. But if we don't manage to do that, we will almost certainly do that again when we are back on dry land. If you'd like to join us in the Mark Stein Club, all you got to do is click on the various banners and buttons that you will see on our homepage. We have lots of great things in the club, including our nightly audio adventure, and I'll be back for that in a couple of hours. If you're totally disgusted by the garbage that you have had to have poured on your head by the world's greatest deliberative body, so-called, through this last day, then do join me for, I think it's, is it episode 14? I think it's episode 14 of John Buchan's Greenmantle, a great adventure yarn from a time when the world was basically falling apart, but you still had men of honor and integrity, which is why no character in that book would ever get near the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you for all your questions. We'll see you next time.